What is with that? Is that some sort of mutation? Or?
It's garlic. That's what garlic does.
Does garlic need no soil or anything?
It's just a bulb.
Yeah, but usually you've got to put them in shit for them to grow.
Yeah, but it's like an onion. Have you ever had onions in your cupboard for so long they start to...
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look, that's not going to become like a big, healthy, happy garlic plant like the ones in my garden if I just left it in my... Because, yes, it does need soil. It does need sun.
What is it with this house that if we're not talking about flesh-eating beetles, we're talking about weird garlic?
It's not weird garlic. It's garlic. It's garlic that I just haven't...
Eat the fucking garlic.
I just haven't had time to cook this month. I've been busy and sick.
Yeah, now you've got weird, strange garlic staring
at me. It's just garlic that's growing.
It's staring at me.
I'll use it. It's no weirder than the lime sitting next to it. Look at that. That I need to throw away. I know. It's like something out of a Robert Aikman story.
On that note. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. This is episode 56 of Writer and the Critic.
Why did you say it in that voice?
Because, I don't know, I like a tonal change every so often, a tonal shift.
Hello, Ian.
Hello, Kirsten. How are you?
I'm okay, except I had a really bad flu a couple of weeks ago, which I'm over, except for this horrible cough. So I apologise, people, if I occasionally cough... Timing. I should be a comedian.
If I cough, I don't have a cough, but if I cough, will that set you off? So if I go...
It's not a yawning thing.
Okay.
No, I will just... So I will try to edit most of them out, but I apologise for the occasional coughing that may interrupt this podcast.
Thank you for that. Well, so that's the podcast then.
Yeah, the whole thing was just me coughing.
what are we doing this month?
I thought you were running it this month.
Oh, yeah.
That's what we're doing.
And I asked you that question while you're taking a sip of your tea.
Yeah, well done.
So good work. So
what are we doing this month?
We are going to talk about two novels that were winners
of... Two books.
You're right. Thank you. We are going to talk about two books that were winners of different categories in the Shirley Jackson Award this year. One of them is the best novel category, which would be Experimental Film by Gemma Files.
Yep.
And the best edited anthology, which is Aikman's Heirs, edited by Simon Strances.
Yes. So we should probably talk a little bit about the actual award first.
It's a juried award.
Yep.
A very good juried award. In fact, one of the few that I religiously read.
It's one of my favourite awards, actually, partially because I really, really, really love Shirley Jackson. So anything with her name on it, it's...
So it's not horror, tonally. It is mystery. It is genre, but it is not purely horror novels. It's books that reflect Shirley Jackson's over her themes and the things that she did. So things that are...
Well, I actually...
Oh, okay.
From the website, because I did my homework, despite being sick... Because they have a very nice little précis of it. So in recognition of the legacy of Shirley Jackson's writing and with permission of the author's estate, the Shirley Jackson Awards have been established for outstanding achievement in the literature of psychological suspense, horror and the dark fantastic, which is a really nice way of, I think...
Yeah, and it's broad.
..clumping together all of those subgenres.
And as a result, and when I say I read... The Jacksons. I read the novels. I don't read anything else because
That would be your year. Because there are many, many categories and,
Well, there's novella
and one year I'd actually really like to just read the Shirley Jackson Award.
Short fiction, that would single be very author cool. collection and edited anthology. And actually, as it happens, we'll end up reading a couple of things anyway.
Yeah. I think maybe post-PhD, the year I finish my PhD is the year I'll read the entire shortlist of the Shirley Jackson Awards for all the categories.
It would be worth it.
Because I've never done that. I've read things off the award list, but I've never read the whole thing. And
completely
really
off topic,
cool.
But I don't really like the novelette category.
Oh.
Not the actual category this year, but just generally having novelette.
Just the,
or frankly,
like the separation of the word count from novella.
I think
it should go short story,
novella,
novel.
And I'm not in that
And include novelette in novella is what you're saying, not like that bunch of stories with that
Correct.
Word count, get rid of them.
Correct.
You're just saying have a short fiction, a longer short fiction and a novel length.
Correct.
Fair enough.
But that's a completely separate issue.
It does allow to have allow more stories to be recognised, I guess, by having the two separate long fiction categories.
It does, but when you look at literary awards, you know they don't give a fuck.
I know.
The Goldsmiths Prize.
We're very
the Goldsmiths Prize, which was announced last month, and We're recording this on the 30th of October. By the way, happy Halloween for tomorrow. But thank you. Happy birthday for tomorrow.
Oh, thank you. But it'll be today when people listen to it for the first time. I'm going to get this up on Monday.
Really?
I'm going to get it up. What? It's the October podcast. It will be up in October.
Okay, well, hello everyone for tomorrow.
Is today.
Yes, which is today.
Happy Halloween.
Thank you. The Goldsmith Prize, you'll have books that are 100,000 words or 12,000 words on the same.
It's interesting. I think we can I think one of the things that we can say completely without, you know, supplementary data, but at least I feel that that us genre readers and as a community, we're quite taxonomy focused.
Oh, fuck yeah.
You know, we do like to put things in boxes.
And this is an award that forget the categories, taxonomy in terms of the genre of the book plays a role, because you really do have a very diverse in the novel, because I've read them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, experimental film, the book we're going to be discussing in about who knows when, in a few minutes, is a out-and-out ghost story.
Yes.
Eileen, though, is only genre in the sense that it's psychological suspense, mm-hmm. so it's got no supernatural element. The Glittering World does. It's about fairies.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the weakest book on this list, but just by the by. Lord Byron's Prophecy is weird. It's more slipstreamy. It's hard to say. I'm not going to go into huge. And When We Were Animals, which is an absolute – you really should read that book, Joshua Gaylord. Fantastic book. But again, sort of magic realist rather than set. You know, it's about a town where the kids at a certain age just become animals, not actually turn into werewolves, but
become an
animalistic.
Animal. Yeah, okay.
It's really, really good. So, you won't see that. That's why I love the Shirley Jacksons, because you won't see that sort of collection of books in any sort of other award that are so different tonally, but fit the definition you read out just before.
Yeah, because, I mean, it is interesting to see that an award which, you know, arguably has a narrow focus in terms of genre, because it's not even just speculative fiction. It's a narrower one than that. It still encompasses such a wide variety of narrative types and styles and so on.
You should also read Lord Byron's Prophecy.
Okay, maybe I'll put them on my ever-growing post-PhD list.
I really don't like the Robert Levy. Sorry, Robert, but I love the rest. It is a really strong list of books.
Yeah, look, as I said, I have quite the affection for this early for the Shirley Jackson Award. Haven't ever read the entire thing, but that's a bucket list plan, I think.
We're stealing from two of the categories. We've mentioned novel and also from edited anthology, which just because I mentioned the novel ones, the edited anthology, and we picked the winners. So the winner was Aikman's Heirs. Am I saying that right? And is it Aikman?
I've always said Aikman, but I don't know. I don't know. Say what you say. Aikman. It's probably Aikman.
The other four were Black Wings 4, edited by S.T. Joshi, The Doll Collection, edited by Ellen Datlow.
Which I've heard very good things about.
But it didn't win.
No, but for God's sake. No, but that one is actually, bookmarked on my wish list. I've heard a lot about that book.
Exegesis. Is that his hat? Exegesis, edited by Richard Thomas, and then Seize the Night, edited by Christopher Golden.
Yes, which I have not heard of the last two, but that is neither here nor there, because I've had my head in a PhD hole all year. So
when will that stop being an excuse,
Kirsten? Two more years. 18 months.
So, on to the books. Perfect segue.
What one are we discussing first?
Experimental film by Gemma Files. Let's go with the novel.
Okay. I really like this book.
So did
I. Lot. It's been a long time since I've read, haven't ever read any of her novels, but I've read a few of her short stories a while ago, and her name was a name that was kind of in my head to keep an eye on as an author, because I liked her short fiction.
Because she wrote the Hexslinger books, is that right?
The Hexslinger trilogy, which I've not read.
See, I own them. I've never read them.
Right.
But that's
well, that's okay. You own them. She's got the royalties. She's got the numbers going. It's all good, but you should read the books. So I was really excited to read this book. It was actually recommended by a couple of people last year, and I'd had it on my to-be-read shelf for a while. So it was nice that it won the Shirley Jackson and sort of it's the prompt to maybe read it. I really, really loved it. I think it's a really good ghost story, and I loved the style in which it was told, that really, not just retrospective, because it, you know, she is telling a story. Literally, the book we're reading is a book.
I was going to ask, it is first person.
The book,
it is a recollection.
Yeah.
Does it play fair?
Yeah, it does.
This is your bugbear.
It more than plays fair. It actually talks about the, like, indirectly addresses the issues with this type of a thing, in really clever ways, which we'll get to. But essentially, the overall conceit of the book is that this book we read, Experimental Film, is actually the book by Lois Carnes, who is the protagonist of the story. This is the book she wrote.
Yeah, but wait a sec. Doesn't that, the artifice of that, bug you? So she's no. So Lois Carnes, is it Carnes or Carnes? Anyway, Lois has written the book Experimental Files, which we're reading.
Yes.
But it's got Gemma Files on the front cover.
What?
No.
Okay, that's part of the pragmatics of publishing, I think, Ian.
No, oh, duh. I know that. I'm just saying that when authors do that, when they create this artificial situation, mm-hmm. why not go the whole hog?
Well, I don't think that the book Lois Carnes has written is called Experimental Film. She never actually gives us a title of the book she's written. It's a conceit. And as I said, like, really, the pragmatics of publishing is a publisher is not going to publish a book called Experimental Film by Lois Carnes. They want a book by Gemma Files.
Yeah, no, I understand.
So, you know, they're not, yes, nice idea. Yes, let's publish a fake book by a fake author. And that has been done. But it's the conceit. You take the conceit, you go, okay, this is the type of book that's being written. And it happens all the time in various forms. We get books that are, you know, purport to be the diary of so-and-so. We get books that are purporting to be, you know, a correspondence of letters between two characters. I mean, that's the conceit. And this is not the first book to say this is the book. The book that the fictional protagonist
has
written.
It just sometimes gets on my...
Yeah.
Not that it did in this case, but Nina Allen actually... in her review on Strange Horizons, takes it a step further. This is really – because I didn't think of it this way, but she said actually it's a film.
Yeah, it's like a novelization of a film.
No. It is a film. That's the experiment. It's a film that completely eschews the medium of film by using words.
Okay.
No, that is a film. But it's so experimental it doesn't actually use film.
Yeah, all right, I might have to read what Nina.
She backs it up. She backs it up in the review, and we'll obviously link
to
it.
Okay, yep, sure. I'll look that up. I'd have to think about that for a bit. That's an interesting idea. I will look up that review and put it into the show notes.
What's the book about?
Okay, so the book's about Lois, who is a ex professor at a not too well regarded film school,
where the budget's been cut.
Where the budget's been cut, and she's been retrenched. I guess we would say. And at about that time that she was retrenched, her son was diagnosed with as being somewhere on the autism disorder spectrum. So these two very significant disruptive things in her life happened around the same time, if I remember correctly. So at the time the events of the book happen. She's dealing with trying to do freelance work in a sector that is rapidly diminishing in terms of opportunity and remuneration.
With a supportive husband.
With a very supportive husband. And also dealing with coming to terms with herself as a mother to a child who was not the child she expected to be a mother to.
Correct.
Which is kind of paraphrasing how she says it at one point in the book, which was a really cool way of talking about
cool's not the word I would use. I think it's very confronting way of describing it.
Yeah. The bit where she's talking about, like, as parents, and she's not specifically referring to her son's autism, I don't think, but she's talking about parents who love their children from birth unequivocally, but part of that love is tangled up with the idea of what that child might be in the future and what happens when that child cannot ever be that future child that you had plans for and dreams for. It was quite an evocative scene.
But it's the strongest part of the book for me.
Yeah.
This whole motherhood when it's not easy.
And
when you personally may not actually have the tools in your own psyche and own psychology to cope with what's actually put ahead. And there's an expectation that you have to cope.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. Yeah.
Well, two things. Not only do you have to cope, but you have to give up everything in your life to cope with this. So, you know, there's this thread that runs through the book that, you know, she's out of a job. Her husband's happy to support her.
Because he's working.
Because he's working.
Yeah. And so also we should say he's sharing the parenting responsibilities.
Yeah. He's a genuinely supportive husband.
Yeah. And father. Saying is like he's not he's just working and she, you know, she's correct. Left with the child. He's sharing
there's
the
this
child
line that there's 50-50. Not a line in the novel, but this thread that runs through, which is, well, why are you even bothered doing
which
this?
Which is mostly
work?
Represented by her mother, by Lois's mother, who is constantly
same.
Is herself struggling with her grandson and how he not just how he behaves, but I think more importantly for Lois's mother, how he does not present affection and emotion in the way that she would like. Whereas Lois is, although Lois does often and vocally express doubt as to how much her son loves her and misses her when she's away, and she says this to her husband as well, not just you know, in her head to the reader, she never doubts that he does love her, and she never ever doesn't love him. Like it's this bond, but she's this lesser version of her mother in a way. She doesn't have the expectation that he displays for her his emotion in a way that Lois's mother would find rewarding or gratifying or just socially acceptable. So she doesn't ever have that expectation that he should do that. But at the same time, she's still got this longing to know that he does love her.
Yeah, no, and there's all of that.
And it's this catch 22.
But there's this thing that is about how selfish is Lois, especially when this project starts getting dangerous. How selfish is she? To be willing to given a situation to just keep going with it, but that's what I loved about the book that it says well no, yes she's got a son in this situation, but that doesn't mean that suddenly she's not a cipher for that. She becomes a non-person because that's all she should be devoting her time to.
Yeah, and it's also I think Lois, as I said, Lois's mother is I guess the conduit for that. Line of argument that Lois should just be a mother, especially as she is a mother with a child who has special needs. So that should be it, right? That should be it. She should neither desire nor pursue any other vocation in her life now that she has a son. Motherhood is it. You know, there's never anything in the book, I don't think, where Lois's mother or another character says the same thing about Simon, Lois's husband, that well maybe he could just quit his job and be the father.
Yeah,
you know?
But it
and
is
part of
the
that
fact,
is pragmatic.
Well, but Lois has just lost her job, so
yes, yeah. But anyway, but the book in itself, though, I think is very supportive of Lois and teases out that need that any adult, regardless of their gender, has to have their own identity. To pursue things other than the fact of their parenthood, if they are a parent, and certainly Simon is incredibly he understands Lois. He loves her. He fell in love with her for a whole bunch of reasons, a lot of which were the fact of her own personality, and he absolutely supports her. There's not. You know, there's only one time in the whole book where he kind of puts his foot down and says, you know, I don't want you to do that thing because it's a really dangerous – at the very end when she's going to confront
Rob.
With a W for wanker. You know, that's the only time he puts his foot down and says, no, I refuse. I'll do it instead. But then when she kind of like gives him the slip and does it anyway, it's not like he goes, okay, you've done it fine. Now what can I do to – support you in it. You know what I mean? Like that's never his role. His role is never to undermine her. His role is never to lay on any kind of guilt or doubt about what she's doing. He completely understands what she's doing and he supports it. And because he's also the other parent of Clark, it is also his job to be that parent. And that's what he does. He's with Clark as Lois is with Clark. He takes care of Clark. He does stuff. He's not just you know, the person who's earning the money. He's not just the guy who, quote unquote, babysits when he needs to. I mean, he's as much a father to Clark as Lois is expected to be a mother. And that was really refreshing in the book, that there's none of that tension between the two parents.
Correct.
That tension came from outside the family unit, like the immediate family unit came from Lois's mother. But there was no tension between the two parents about who they're allowed to be and what their roles are within the family.
And Lois gets quite obsessed with this project, which we haven't discussed about.
I mean,
as most characters do in ghost stories, when they get really drawn into the ghost story element, and yet he's always there for her.
Yeah. So the ghost story, which I think is a really that's such a cool way that this book, I guess, structures itself.
I'm going to ask a question before you start. Had you ever heard of Lady Midday?
I hadn't heard of Lady Midday, like the specific Lady Midday myth, but there are very similar folk tales of noonday goddesses and things like that.
Explain this to me. A goddess appears holding a scythe during harvest season or summer, which is, you know, harvest season.
Getting towards harvest season,
Asks someone some really hard questions, and if she doesn't like the answer, chops her head off. That's the myth.
Yeah, well, it's sort of like, yes, so it's a folk tale. Okay. But this
– To what aim?
What do you mean what aim? There are no aims. The motif of a magical or sort of deific figure, posing quandaries or quests or questions, or often being in disguise and to test a character's true nature, etc., it's so common as to be laughable. Like, it's everywhere. That's one of the a very basic device of a lot of fairy tales and folk tales. This idea that someone you meet will ask you to do something or ask you questions, and there'll be something odd about them, and whether the character does them or not will determine their fate. And often, if they are rude to a person, they will meet a very bad end. That's quite a common device that's used. And I hadn't heard of, in particular, the Lady Midday story, but there are a couple. Like, it was familiar. It was very familiar to me. It's not like I went, Lady Midday, but it's like, it's one of those stories.
It wasn't familiar to me at all.
So in the folktale that Iris Whitcomb relates in the book, that is...
Which we're skipping a lot of plot here.
We are skipping a lot of plot.
We're assuming
you've read it, listeners. it revolves around the young boy who goes out and doesn't look at Lady Midday, because that's nothing, you know, don't look at the, you know, I mean, there's all these motifs that are very common to don't look at the god, don't look at the monster, don't look at thing, right? Just, close your eyes and be okay. I mean, that runs through the whole of experimental film, the idea that you can't look, you can't look, you can't look. If you look, things are bad. You've just got to take it on faith that thing is there. You know, so the young boy who has been warned against her, so he doesn't look at her, he doesn't accept any of her offerings. She offers him water, she offers him, you know, because also accepting things from creatures in folk tales and fairy tales often doesn't bode well. But he's polite and he's deferent. As a reward for that, as a reward for treating Lady Midday as her station deserves, she gives him a boon. Whereas the farmer, who's rude to her, and yes,
because Lady Whitcomb is from Europe.
Yeah. So,
and as a young girl, her father got her head chopped off by Lady Midday.
Got his head chopped off.
Yes.
That's interpretation the book is kind of pushing us to, I believe.
I'm pretty sure that's where I'm being directed to, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, this is a supernatural novel.
Yes.
This is not Lady Midday as a
metaphor. Lady Midday is in this book. So anyway, so that's the basic folk tale, I guess.
But how does that tie into the films, Kirsten?
Oh, gosh. I should have read the back of the book, shouldn't I? That would have been so much easier. So Lois, who is still a film critic, although she's not, hasn't been paid for her film criticism for a while. She goes along to see this experimental film, that this guy Rob with a W, has made. And it's one in a long series of crappy experimental films he's made. But in this one, he has illegally sampled material from his former place of work, which was a film archive place. And it's that material which is an old 1920-era film made on silver nitrate by Iris Whitcomb. And that's what attracts Lois's attention, because that's this little flickering of something that's good and intriguing amid the dross of the actual film she's gone to see. So and it also sparks her memory of reading this Lady Midday folktale as a young girl in the book she later
because the sampling is of the folktale.
The sampling is of the film that Iris Whitcomb made based on the folktale.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
So all of this is what brings Lois in. And, yeah, as you said, as the novel proceeds, she gets more and more obsessed with tracking down evidence that Iris Whitcomb did in fact make these early films that were found in a cache on silver nitrate, because so no one knows who made them, and it would be the evidence. If she finds the evidence that it was Iris Whitcomb, it's that thing, it will make her name, it will get her book published, it will bring her back into the world that she wants to be in, because she'll have solved this mystery of not only who these films were made by, but also establishing that Iris Whitcomb was one of the first filmmakers, and a female filmmaker at that, in the history of Canadian film.
Canadian film, which there is a shitload of history of there Canadian is, film in this is. Book.
So that's where she's coming from in the beginning, in terms of just her own interest, and furthering her, or you know, reconnecting with the career that she's kind of
And there's
of
a
lost.
Mystery surrounding Lady Whitcomb as well. She disappeared suddenly.
Yeah, she disappeared on a moving train.
All that was left was an ashy smear.
Yeah.
Which sort of...
And the theory was that she was playing some silver nitrate film in her carriage, because there was the remains of a projector there too, and it exploded because silver nitrate is highly flammable. So...
And talk about a gun on the wall.
So it begins...
Talk about a gun on the wall.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course. You're
told a lot of times. Silver nitrate, flammable.
And forget that. You're told, like, in the first quarter of the novel that, Rob has allegedly caused a conflagration before in a rival who he wanted to destroy. So he burnt a building down. And it's all – and the beauty of this book, because this book that we're reading – by Gemma Files is also a book by Lois Carnes, and it's all told in retrospect. So Lois, the character, has had the time to think about the events that have happened, to work out a way to structure them to tell this story. It is a pure told story. That there's nothing in this book that Lois doesn't already know every step of the way, and she's structuring the story with her knowledge of film and narrative in the best way to bring the reader in. So she says she can't start by telling you the most unbelievable thing, because you never will believe it. So she's got to ease the reader in by talking about this very non-supernatural mystery of this filmmaker and so on. And she seeds in the weirder stuff along the way to, I guess, acclimatize us to the possibilities that the solution behind this mystery is something not of this world.
I mean, yeah, the structure is very, very smart. I mean,
and she tells you all the way, but it's not annoying. Like, I think it would have been very easy for a book like this to be quite annoying.
It's not on the nose foreshadowing.
It's not on the nose. It's definitely...
I mean, there's foreshadowing.
Yeah, explicitly so. She tells you. She tells you along the way what she's doing and why she's choosing this particular narrative device or this particular structure. And that could have been really irritating, you know. It could have been really irritating, but the way Files has written the book and the way she's written Lois and created Lois as a character, it doesn't come across as that. It comes across less as a character who's trying to show how clever she is by saying, ha-ha, look at this, I'm starting with action instead of exposition in order to, you know, provide a palatable way into the necessary exposition. Instead of that, she's coming across as a character who is really knowledgeable about this field and really passionate about this field and wanting to share that knowledge and passion rather than saying to the reader, I'm so clever, I'm cleverer than you. It's a different dynamic that she's having with her expected readership in this book.
Yeah, I mean, there was a part of me that got it was sad when the supernatural element kicked in, because I actually could have just read a whole book about Lois's views on Canadian film.
and the mystery of Iris Whitcomb, if it was a...
Well, yeah, and the mystery as well.
I do sometimes
get this, not reluctance, but I feel, did this fantastical element need to be there? And yes, it's probably my issue with ghost stories generally, in that they're often about other things, and then the ghost story is there to, as either a metaphor or something to push the narrative along. And there's so much interesting stuff in this book. Did we need to actually have this idea of Lady Midday caught in the celluloid, being instantiated?
What would be the alternative?
Well, Rob on his own is a real, as you said, wanker. Mm. He's a real asshole. Rob as a villain, and he is the villain of the piece. It's not really Lady Midday.
No,
it's Rob. That conflict between the two of them, because there's this whole thing about one stealing the other's IP and that to and fro, and who's gonna reveal the truth of Lady Whipcomb first. That in of itself is tense, rather than the Lady Midday aspect, which is a bit I've seen before. The whole idea of, it's not new, the whole idea of
nothing super, is new.
No, but the book's called Experimental Film. The whole notion of the supernatural element being caught in photo/film.
Yeah, of course,
And then it all ending in conflagration and fire, which is, I don't know. There were other things that interested me that weren't the supernatural bit.
No, I agree. I think the literal presentation of Lady Midday as some kind of a god figure, or at the very least a supernatural entity. And I agree, she's not the villain, but she is the antagonist. And I think there's a difference. I think Rob is the villain of the novel, but I think Lady Midday is the antagonist of Lois.
Yes,
There's a good line at the very start where Lois says something about, this is my story, so I will start with this thing that happened to me. And she said, because I'm the protagonist, not the hero, never the hero.
Yes, never the hero, yeah.
And that there is that differentiation. So Lois is the protagonist and Lady Midday is her antagonist. And then you've got Rob on the side, who's the villain, and he's there to provide all the mechanics that a villain needs to provide in terms of thwarting and setting back what the character's achieved and all that sort of stuff, and that's what he does. But Lady Midday is the actor in this film, who is in direct opposition to who Lois is and what she wants for herself and her family and her life. And Lady Midday isn't working to thwart Lois in her, her day-to-day quest, but she is working to undermine Lois herself.
No, because we should say there are parallels. I mean, it's not, I want to make it clear, I'm not saying that the supernatural element is just tacked on and it's...
No,
because as
not.
You well said, she leads us into
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
This is very, very carefully led into. It's, and there is a parallel with Whitcomb / Lady Midday in that, Whitcomb has a son who dies.
Yeah, who is, I guess, posthumously by the characters in this book assumed to also have had autism of some kind.
Yes, so correct. And not be, yes. And so there is that parallel. So there's an intimacy to it as well.
And the boy is taken by Lady Midday.
Correct. And that's the same threat that hangs over Clark. So, no, I get all that. Where I'm coming from, and it's not a major criticism of this book. It is a very, very good book.
Yeah.
But there's that – I always get that uneasiness, and not the good uneasiness, which we'll talk more about when we talk about Aickman's Heirs, a book that has that real strong, grounded, mimetic feel to it, really grounded. I mean, she's talking about Canadian history, film history, the autism stuff. It's really grounded. And then there's this weirdness that comes in from the side, and it is fucking hard to pull that off. I think she more or less does it.
I still felt a little bit
uncomfortable in it.
I can completely, because there was a bit at the end or near the end, before the penultimate scene in the theatre. So, because everything that happens after the theatre is really epilogue. It's a lengthy epilogue, but it's really epilogous to the novel. Where I think I was feeling what you were feeling. It was like, it doesn't. I really liked the unsettled nature of this novel, and then you approach a point where that become settled.
Yeah, that's it. Well, she
and it's settled not by saying, oh, it was all made up and blah, 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 and Lady Midday's not real and the world is real as we know it and blah, blah, blah. But it's settled in the other way. Oh, Lady Midday is really supernatural and blah, blah. But the question either way is settled. And that's, for me as a reader of these types of stories, is there's always a small disappointment there in the settling. Because it's the unsettled aspect that I love.
That's why I like the Paul Tremblay book so much that we read.
Yeah, because it's unsettled.
Always, throughout the whole, it leaves that unsettling.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, Gemma Files lands, as you said, lands on the supernatural.
I mean, we had a different, I think we walked away from A Head Full of Ghosts slightly different. I walked away quite confident that none of the supernatural stuff was real, and I thought the text, my reading of the text supported that, but I could see how it remained open to someone who did want to still think that all the supernatural stuff could have happened. Whereas, with experimental films, there's no question that
correct.
What all of the Lady Midday stuff and all of the supernatural
the only question
is assumed to have actually happened.
Yeah, it's all true in the eyes of Lois. I mean,
this is one of the things I really loved about
experimental film. Assistant.
Yeah, one of the things I loved about this film is about this book is it is very bold in both its narrative techniques and I guess its supporting documentation, for want of a better word. So there's so much of this book that Lois doesn't remember. She doesn't remember because she blacks out. Because
she has migraines. Yeah. Especially when
she goes to visit the house. I don't know, attacked isn't the right word, but she gets seen, she gets touched by Lady Midday, and in those...
That's in the house when she goes to visit Woodcombe's house.
In the greenhouse and stuff, And in those times she can't remember things. But there are a few times where she hasn't remembered stuff. And so what she's doing is she's reconstructing that from the tape recordings and the video recordings that her and Safie, who is her assistant on this project to find Iris Whitcomb and prove she was the author of the films... So she's piecing together, and she's quite explicit in saying, I'm watching myself on this film and I say this and I might be thinking that, but I might have been thinking this other thing and I don't know. And there's bits of audio that she's played back and she will say things like, well, it does sound like me. It sounds like something I would say. I don't remember saying it, but she's quite forensic in her, reconstruction of what happened. So there's none of this thing of the character just going, well, I have no idea what happened. And she doubts, like she's put it back together, but she's still quite honest in the fact that there are gaps and she does have doubts.
Yep.
And she can't reliably back up what the story that she has put together.
Yep.
But at the same time, the book does give us Safie, who is another person there who doesn't have blackouts, who can also back stuff up. This is not a book where Lois is on her own, as with so many of these books where the characters are obsessed and everyone around them can't see what they saw and can't, you know. Safie also sees things that are inexplicable.
Yeah, there's lingering doubt. And, because of the foreshadowing, you expect is it Sophie? Is it
Safie.
Safie. Yeah. You expect her to die horribly.
I know, and she never does. Oh, no. Spoilers.
Yeah. But anyway, there is that lingering aspect toward the end where they both agree that this stuff could be dug up again.
Yeah.
And so there is a recognition that this is not over.
Yeah.
And this supernatural thing is still...
Is still there. But Safie never... Like, There's never an antagonism between Lois and Safie. No. There was never... I kept kind of expecting Safie to betray her at some point. And there are betrayals in this book by secondary characters because Rob is an asshole and has lots of money and does tend to bribe people. But... there's never any betrayal of Lois by the people who she trusts. Safie is there to the end and believes her the whole time. Yep. She comes to the same belief.
Which is why I assume she'd die horribly.
Yeah, she comes to the same belief as Lois does pretty much at the same time, maybe a heartbeat after. But she believes Lois.
Yeah, that's right.
Simon believes Lois.
Yeah.
I mean, there's none of this, I guess, conventional tension that you have between the protagonist of a book like this and the people around them who they love and trust. It's just not there.
And Clark Simon believes because Clark has been directly affected by this supernatural menace.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he
is because Lady Midday comes to visit Clark.
Yeah.
So, yes, I mean, I this book is quite unusual in how it presents the dynamics between the characters. And it shows you that you do not have to have a protagonist in a book like this who is isolated and disbelieved and threatened by her immediate actors.
Yep.
You know, you can have a book where the character is absolutely believed by the people she loves and trusts and that's, supported by
that's
them.
That's probably the most experimental aspect of the film. the book.
But it really is, right? Because often, like in a book like this, the husband or, you know, more commonly the wife, the supportive wife, wouldn't believe them. Oh, I know you believe what you believe, but really I'm making a phone call to the doctor to get you more medication. You know, and the best friend would not be, and the assistant at some point might.
Yep.
But in this book, that none of that happens.
Or if they do are supportive, they die horribly at some point.
Or they die horribly at some point, and the protagonist is left isolated. And Lois is isolated in the sense that she has been chosen by Lady Midday, but she's not isolated in her support network, and she's not betrayed by her support network, and that was refreshing in a book which still has betrayal and tension and doubt and all of the stuff you need to motor along a suspenseful narrative, but it doesn't come from the people that she loves and trusts, and that's rare. That's so rare, and really, you know, it's wonderful to witness.
Yep, I agree.
Because none of us want to be in a situation where the people we love and trust most suddenly decide we're batshit crazy or, you know, betray us in some way.
But it's telling that I expected it throughout the whole book. Either they were
because
to die
because that's the
or...
way these books work.
Correct.
Usually that's the way these books work. You know, someone we love will betray us or someone we love will die, and that's how you get the tension. And it's an easy way to get tension, but I think what Gemma Files proves quite unequivocally with experimental film is it's not the only way to do that.
Also,
it's not
because
necessary.
The subject matter is so is fascinating on its own without the need for artificial shit like betrayal. I mean, other than Rob himself, as you said, the Lady Whitcomb story is genuinely interesting.
Yeah,
And the way her husband tried to fix her, you know, doing swear cries.
And the Lady Midday folktale is genuinely horrific.
Yes.
You know, and not just the folktale, but the history around the folklore and what it was supposed people did.
So it's Wendish, that's right?
Yeah, and the Wends were, I don't know a lot about them, but it's a Germanic. Or
see, I always turn to you for this sort of stuff because I know nothing.
They're not German, but they're a group which lived in, I think, southwestern Germany as we know it now, but they were kind of absorbed culturally by the Germanic people. So they're not German, but you often find Wendish folktales turning up in sort of collections of German folktales and
but
stuff.
Are
like
there
that.
People who identify as Wendish today?
Oh, no, yeah. Small, like I think it's a really small, it's probably like an endangered cultural group or something, but I mean, it is a real group. It's not made up. Wends are real.
No, I know it's not made up.
and continuing, it is a continuing culture.
Okay, well.
In probably a very diluted form because this is how monocultures work.
In conclusion, really. I really like the book.
Yeah,
it's
I really
it's a deserving
liked
winner
it.
Of the Shirley Jackson Award.
And can I?
I would have given it personally. I would have given it to Eileen, but this is still very deserving.
Just before we conclude, one of the things that, and you mentioned it before, how it was quite confronting the portrayal of Lois as a mother to an autistic child, and it was a little confronting when she first begins to talk about Clark. But the thing I found wonderful about this book is near the end, when Lady Midday is, I guess, in audience, or when Lois is in audience with Lady Midday and she forces the audience to try to trap her or whatever Lois thinks she can do, which clearly doesn't work. But Lady Midday is doing the thing that that magical beings and godlike beings do in that they tempt the supplicant.
Yes.
So if you follow me, if you do your duty, which, oh, how much does that echo Lois's mother saying, do your job, this is your job, this is your job, and Lady Midday going, well, this is your job. You know, it's this wonderful tension that pulls at Lois. But one of the things she offers Lois is, well, you know, Lois will become this amazing author and her books will be millions of copies and she'll be on, you know, she'll get interviewed and her career will be amazing and her husband Simon will get this promotion and do this thing he always wanted to do. And Clark, her son Clark, will shed his autistic traits and be able to live in the world as a neurotypical person and be able to express his emotions and his love for Lois and his love for his grandmother, and his life will be smooth. And as I was reading it, it was like, oh, no, 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 no. And it's not only does the book, like, Lois refuses.
You were saying no, 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 because you thought that Lois would go, yay, I want that.
Well, no, because the way the book is set up, I was almost certain as a reader that would be refused. Because also, this is what happens in these types of tales. The protagonist, the good protagonist, the protagonist we're rooting for, refuses.
No, but they're often tempted.
Yeah, but she refuses the temptation. Yeah, okay. But I thought the way that was being set up, it felt like, yeah, because, you know.
Felt like what?
Okay, because Simon getting a promotion and getting the job he really wants, an objectively good thing. Lois, you know, becoming a successful film critic and author and book tours, objectively good thing. And then you have Clark, and it's like, oh, this one of these things is not like the other in terms of, you know, the inherent goodness of it. And that felt, for that moment, what the book was presenting, and it was.
Oh, I see.
What the book does then, because it's not just that Lois refuses it, it's the reason why she refuses it, because she has the, and it's an, almost an immediate, I think there is that moment of temptation, because it is there, because what parent doesn't want the easiest life for their child?
Yep.
And she has no doubts whatever that Lady Midday can make all of this happen, and all she has to do is serve Lady Midday, which she's kind of doing anyway because of her obsession. But she has this immediate realization that whatever the young man and the adult man that Clark would become if this happened wouldn't be Clark.
Yeah, would not be his son anymore.
And I'm just going to read the paragraph actually, because it would be so much more effective than me paraphrasing it. It's from a dream that she has, and it's a dream that's reconstructing her audience with Lady Midday. And then Clark on stage two, performing, singing, his music spilling out of him, touching the world, saying, I love you, Mummy, with perfect clarity, perfect eye contact. I've always loved you. This is for you, because of you, all of it. Thank you for my life. But no, I put hands to my eyes, felt the tears pouring down, felt myself tense, sudden, head to toe rigid. That's not my son. Because sure, she could show me something like him. Maybe even give me something like him, like what he might have been, but it would be forever a fake, nothing but a doll made from dreams and dead flowers. And that's amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Like, it's not just the refutation of the offering, but it's why.
Yeah.
And the way Lois/Files explains it. And I think that, like, it's a short part of the book, and it's, a lot of the book is talking about the difficulty of being a mother to a child like Clark, and her doubts about her ability to mother him and her own emotional capacity. But this one little part right at the end nails the fact that for all of her doubts, all of her worries and self-recriminations and the complicated, tangled feeling she has for her son, she recognises his autonomy. She recognises his right to be himself rather than what she as a mother might want for him. And it's quite remarkable.
It is. And it's a powerful end.
Yeah.
And a powerful statement.
And it's
to what is a very good novel. And in fact, just that justifies any uneasiness I have around the supernatural element.
Oh, there you go.
No, it does, because it grounds it back in reality again. It makes it concrete.
It does.
This is about me recognising, as you said, the autonomy of my son and his right to have his identity flourish without, you know,
without conforming to the expectations of other people,
correct.
Which in the case of Clark is not just a request to conform, but it's an impossible request to conform.
Correct.
You know? And, yeah, but the book is very – like, as I said, I recommend it to our listeners to read.
Well, you should have read it already, but if you haven't.
It's a very complicated and tangled portrait of this type of a family and the relationship that Lois has with her son and the relationship she sometimes wishes she might have with her son. It's not a book that is black and white, and, you know, it presents the complexity and it presents the entanglement of these emotions. And I really, really appreciated it.
So did I. And on that note, let's move to the second
book. Okay. You talk about this one.
Okay. Which is Aikman's Heirs, edited by Simon Strances. Yes, that's what I'm going to say. Beautiful cover. Sort of a look, I can't describe things, but it's got that whole windswept, grainy, sepia tone to it. It's just gorgeous, the cover. Okay, so Robert Aikman. I know nothing. No, that's not true. I know nothing about
Robert
Aikman
because
that's bullshit. I mean, if you've been in fantasy genre horror world for as long as I have,
you know,
as long as
you have,
the name is exactly. But I can't say I've read a single word of Aikman. And I, as it happens, yesterday, Matthew Chaney on the electricliterature.com website wrote a whole piece on Aikman.
It's a really good piece. I read that yesterday, actually.
Oh, you saw my link or you just happened to come
across it? I saw your link after I read the piece. It's funny.
Yeah. No, I didn't read it all. I skimmed bits of it.
Because, it's a really good piece. We'll link to it.
But it did it didn't clarify. It confirmed what I already thought Aikman probably – I mean, Simon does in his introduction does some of that, but it confirmed what I thought Aikman would be about just by reading the stories.
Yeah. So what was that though? This is interesting.
So
what's your impression of Aikman by his
Heirs? The key thing, and I want to get back to the Heirs bit in a second,
but
the key thing is, you know how we said that Gemma settles?
Yes.
Aikman, and actually the stories in this book, never settle. Well, for 90%
of
the time.
Yeah.
In fact, there's one story, this is reasonably common. One story, which isn't necessarily the strongest, at least not like Most Night by John Howard.
Which one's that one?
So that's the one where a guy is working with this other guy in an office and suddenly he invites him over to his house. What I loved about that story is any other anthology collection, it would all have been about that cult and what that cult's about. But the guy literally gets up in the story, the guy who's been brought in, because he's been asked to become a member of this cult. They need six people, and he'll be the sixth.
It's like, come over to our house for dinner, and instead they start talking about this weird
cult
scheme.
And he goes to the toilet at one point and goes into a room and there's a big fridge in the room. Just open, a fridge that's open and it's pouring out cold. And the whole thing about the cult is something to do with coldness, but that's the point.
Yes.
We don't really know what this cult's about.
Because the guy...
There's a snowflake on the wall that keeps changing.
Yes.
But that's about it. And what's brilliant? The guy just leaves.
Yeah, the protagonist goes, this is weird shit. And he gets up and goes.
He just goes. And I thought...
I love that.
I thought, that's great.
Yeah,
Settle, because the settling would have been, the cult's this and he's got to escape and he ends up dying or getting sucked into it. And he goes, what the fuck? This is all fucked up. Bye.
I haven't...
And it fits into the anxiety of the character who's just socially awkward, doesn't really want to go out.
Yeah, and he's not really I guess he's a colleague who invited him over, but boss. It's his boss, though. So there's a power dynamic there.
Correct.
Where he feels obligated to accept the invitation.
But all the conventions.
And also anxious about, this is my boss and
all the conventions of that sort of story are completely overthrown. And it is not the only story that does that.
Yeah.
There are a few. In fact, while I'm on a roll.
Okay,
on a roll here at this point. There's another one that sort of does that as well, is The Dying Season by Linda Rucker. Which, again, there's something weird. I mean, so it's about a leisure resort.
In the
UK. A couple go there. It's off season, so there's not many people there.
And it's the place where the man in the couple
The boyfriend.
The boyfriend has always, his family's gone there forever.
Correct. And there are two gothy types who are there. And, the convention there is that the gothy types...
They're vampires.
Are the vampires, or as actually suggested in the story, are the sort that go and kill people in cabins and then live in the cabin.
I kind of suspected they were vampires who killed people and lived in their cabins.
The suggestion is there's something odd about
them. But you never know.
You never, ever know. And again, the convention... And in fact, this is the boyfriend goes off with the female of the species, goes off with her. And the girlfriend just goes, you know what? I'm leaving now.
Yeah.
It just goes.
Because he's an ass anyway.
He's an ass, but the point
is... And she's already...
The point is, I get all that. I agree. But the convention is that she stays.
Yeah.
And finds out what... I mean, we don't know. He's gone for about an hour longer. And there's no feeling that he's going to... And the boyfriend's still sitting there, the gothy boyfriend is still sitting there being weird. And she just thinks, well, fuck this. I'm off. And she's happy.
And she goes and she hitchhikes home.
Yeah. And you think that's just outside the convention. I mean, the rug was constantly being pulled from underneath me.
Yeah. I mean, also but with that story.
Now, I don't know if Aikman did that specifically, but that feeling of not settling, of not just going with the flow of the story.
I think it's been I've got several collections. I haven't read any Aikman for
So you're going to say Aikman
years.
And I'm going to say Aikman.
But, yeah, I haven't read any Aikman for, like, 10, 15 years, possibly longer. And I couldn't – I don't think I could tell you the plot of any one particular story, but what's remained with me is the impressions of, yes, like the ambiguities in the stories, the fact that you're quite off kilter as a reader because you never are quite sure exactly what is happening, even by the end. And yeah, I think they are the very definition of not unsettling, although they are, but unsettled. They're unsettled stories. And I know that drives some people completely spare, and I kind of completely understand it. Sometimes you want to know.
This could potentially be an extremely frustrating collection for people.
Yeah.
Because even the stuff that is overtly supernatural, you're not really sure. I mean,
most of the time you're not really sure. I think the weaker stories are the ones where you get what happened and why it happened.
Can you think of
it? And there aren't that many of them. But, well, there's one – and I loved 90% of this story. It's called A Delicate Craft by D.P. Watt, and it's that the Polish construction worker who ends up learning lace work from the old
lady.
Which
is great.
And it's a wonderful story
until the
very end. And then, like, it's a very the ending is – the reveal about what happens is A, revealed.
It's abrupt, which a lot of the stories are, but too abrupt. It feels –
it's too abrupt, but you also – you get what happened. You go, oh, okay, it's a body switch. All right. You know, it was like it's. I didn't need that. I wanted it to remain odd, and I wanted the relationship between him and her to remain this rather sweet for most of the story, but also just there was something again slightly off kilter about it, and I think the story it ended just a little too late. It should have ended a little sooner and left us with this. I'll say it again: unsettled feeling about.
Yeah.
What this relationship was and the impending threat to the protagonist. And the other one was called Camp, which I guess is a play on words because the two protagonists are a gay, just married couple on their honeymoon. And again, that was very strange and very weird. And then at the end, it's like it's a supernatural ending, but it settles. It tells you what happens.
I love that story, David. That's the David Nichols story.
Yeah,
I love that story because that actually it's really good there that you brought those two up because I think that did what the Delicate Craft didn't do so well. That the intrusion of the supernatural, which still isn't explained. I mean, what the fuck's going on there? A canoe capsizes.
Yeah, the mechanics of what actually happened to turn them into.
But it felt completely natural within the tone of the story.
Yeah, I don't know. It seemed to.
No, because there's this whole. Again, I think Nichol, like a lot of the authors here, are playing with the convention. So they meet, they're going off on holiday. They meet an elderly couple.
Yep.
Who get all excited about, why don't you come meet us at our place, which is off the beaten track. So already there's this idea of, well, it's off
something
the beaten track,
gonna
something
happen.
Bad's going to happen.
And something bad happens.
Something bad does happen, but not in the way you'd expect.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And in a sense, nothing to do with the couple. I mean, they do appear at the very, very end, but they don't like a
well, I
– you know, that, there's no,
yeah,
there's no,
see, I did suspect it was to do with the couple.
No, but the couple are clearly frightened from what we can tell at the very end.
It's simply, maybe.
Well, there you go. Yeah. There's that beautiful ambiguity that we keep going back to.
And look, it's not a bad story. I don't think any of the stories in this anthology are bad stories. I think it's really solid.
Because you could say the same about the Nina Allen, A Change of Scene, where that's a longer story. It's essentially a novella or novelette. And towards the end, I mean, what the fuck? What's actually happened there to Frin? What's happened there to?
I loved the Nina.
Oh, it's amazing! It's an amazing piece of writing.
I absolutely loved it. That's one of my favourites in the whole anthology.
I think it is my favourite.
And yeah, I loved it. I loved the dynamic that was set up. I loved the change of relationship between the two characters and the retrospective change in their relationship that the protagonist begins to build. Yeah.
And the way things are revealed about her relationship with Gerald and all that sort of stuff, it's just a beautifully written story. But then has that ambiguity of has Fryn travelled back in time or – and why are there two separate endings? And these aren't questions of, oh, my God, this is shit. These are
– yeah, no, they're questions
that leave you thinking. They leave you thinking and in fact compel you to reread the story, which I didn't.
but you might.
And that's the same with the Brian Evanson.
Oh, my God, that's one of my favorite. I think – like I read – that's the first story in the anthology. And I read it and was like, oh, this is going to be a good book.
Yeah, well, that's it. And that's another story where you feel –
I think that's possibly my favorite. It's such a good story. It is completely inexplicable, and yet, like having read it, that I know what's happened, but I couldn't articulate it properly.
100% correct. You have just said exactly how I feel about this entire, but especially that story. Yeah. Yes, and I think that's Aickman, isn't it? That's the feeling I got from Matthew Chaney. Say that again. That was perfectly said. I know what happened, but I can't really articulate it.
Which is the perfect way, when you think about it, to approach the weird, the uncanny, whatever phrase you're going to use. By nature, something that is uncanny or too weird, it cannot be articulated. As soon as you articulate it, you have made it ordinary. You have, you know, applied a taxonomy. You have cataloged it. You have looked at it. You have shone a light on it, and it is no longer inexplicable.
But we're so forced, whether by culture, media, whatever, to settle.
Yeah, yeah. And
is it real or is it not real? And ambiguity shits people.
It does. But there's ambiguity, which I think is
needlessly frustrating.
It's cheap,
like Lost.
Yeah, and it's just frustrating. And you get the the sense, like, you know, not mentioning any names, Lost, that the writers just didn't know what the fuck they were doing, so just left it somewhere.
I still like the finale, but anyway, let's go
and try to pretend that's what they were planning all along. But then you have an ambiguity, like in a lot of these stories, and other, like, some of my favorite stories. I like House of Leaves, which is inherently ambiguous, and offers so many readings, even to the same reader on multiple occasions, where the ambiguity is a fabric of the story because it refuses an explanation, and it's that refusal to find the explanation, the refusal for the shadow in the corner to resolve itself when you turn the light on, the refusal of the weird thing that happened to you that you just can't explain. It's that feeling of a living with ambiguity that for some people is the worst thing in the world, and for some of us it's like delicious little thing which is separate from the world.
Yeah, I think when it's done well, like it is with most of these stories, it's a case of that the stories themselves aren't promising answers at any point.
No, and then the ones that deliver them are like, oh.
That's right.
With
Seaside Town by Brian Evanson, the opening story.
God, I love that story.
Which is essentially about a man and woman who go off to a seaside town.
Yeah, they're in a burgeoning relationship.
Yeah, burgeoning relationship. He more reluctant than
her. He doesn't like going on holiday.
There's a lot of socially awkward people in these stories.
But, yes.
he doesn't like going. And then weird – it's too easy to say weird shit happens because it's more than that. It's this claustrophobia that even when he goes outside, there's this just constant tightening of the environment around him. And of course, there's something dark in the night, and there's things like that. But there's never a promise from the author, from Evanson, that he's going to ever fucking explain what's going on.
No,
you just go along with the ride.
That's part of the story. I think there's, there are stories that open doors and just let you wander through and take away what you will, and then there are stories that close the door behind you. And for me, as a reader, when I think about my favorite stories and the stories that linger with me, and even if they're not necessarily the best thing I've ever read or watched, but there's something about them lingers, and what lingers with me is the unconscious gnawing over in my head about exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And not because the author wasn't skilled enough or clever enough to write a good story, but because they've written such a good story that they're able to leave you with that dissonance without it feeling like it's just frustrating. Yeah, which is and what's really what a lot of these off. It's really hard
and
to put off.
And the fact that Simon Strances was able to curate and collect a bunch of these, I mean, these are some very good writers here. Let's not kid ourselves. There's some, because yeah, there are quite a lot of familiar names, but that he was able to do that is excellent. I mean, there was, the, I mean, and then there's also this feeling that I got that in some of these stories, and I suppose John Langan's one is top of the list for that. The John Langan story, which is called Underground Economy. So, is this feeling that the character at the who's telling us the story or is the protagonist actually is a sideshow to what's really going on, and that the true story is happening to other people elsewhere.
Yeah.
And they're just seeing a small fraction, you know, the old cliche of the tip of the iceberg. You know, they're not seeing what's going underneath the water. Yeah. And that story really, I mean, I loved it, but that, you know, weird shit, inexplicable shit occurs. It's to do with strippers as well, so, you know, that's...
That was one of my least favourite ones.
No, see, I knew it would be, but it mentioned Showgirls, so I like.
I know.
But no, because it is, there's something going on with these weird guys that come to the strip club and this one stripper who services them.
Yeah.
But there's no explanation.
Yeah. I think it was the tone of that story didn't grab me, I don't think.
Well, actually, talking about the tone, I was actually on getting the concern three stories in that they were all going to be sort of that... oldie worldy, faux 19th century steampunk style.
That's the thing, like, and I think where
the fact that there are stories
there
that
are
like this one that are clearly urban,
and I would have actually liked to have seen more of that, because it's not I agree with you. I think with and Aikman's not 19th century. He was writing and publishing in the 50s, 60s and 70s, mostly the 60s and 70s, I think. So it's not like he was like writing 100 years ago. But his style, like from memory, it was that not quaint, but
proper.
The characters often refer to by their last names, and just the quite more formal register in terms of how they were written. I have the impression from memory that they were mostly third person narrators, third person viewpoints as well. But again, it's been a long time. I can't remember clearly. And I think with this book, I agree with you. I think the majority of the stories were not aping that style, but they had that flavour. And I don't think that is what Aikman is. I think Aikman is the content of the stories and how they're presented, not necessarily the precise words used and sentence structure used to present them. And I think some of these stories, and I think the Evanson is one of them that uses that kind of style.
So does the Nina Allen.
Yeah. And I don't know. I would have liked to see, as much as I liked the anthology, I would have liked to see more of the authors writing in less of an Aikman-esque style,
more colloquially,
more 21st century, more with the same ambiguities and the same strangeness and the same refusal to explain things and the socially awkward characters and the characters who refuse to look and all of that stuff, but written as you'd write a 21st
which leads
century.
Me neatly to the Lisa Tuttle.
I love the Lisa Tuttle,
the book that finds you, which is written just like that.
Yeah, it is one of the strongest stories in that collection.
And it's probably the most metafictional in the
sense. It's another one that refuses – it has a not the protagonist character, but it has a character who refuses to look. I think that's what's so fascinating about a lot of, I guess, the stories in this collection, and therefore you can say one of the things that this collection is saying as a whole is don't look, walk away, you'll be safe.
Yes.
Whereas with experimental film – Lois does nothing but look.
Yes.
She can't help but look. Even at the end where there's, the films that have been made to trap Lady Midday, she has to look. She can't not look. She cannot help herself. She cannot. And other characters in the book, it was like Iris Whitcomb and their refusal to not go back and look that lands them in trouble. But Lois doesn't. Lois looks and refuses to close her eyes, and there's a line that she says near the end where she's saying sometimes it's not about not looking, it's not about not knowing, it's about knowing and learning how to live with the consequences of knowing.
Yep.
And that's a really powerful line. And often in horror or ghost stories or things like this, it is the looking that punishes a character. It is the characters who walk away, the characters who refuse to look, the characters who resist the temptation, who resist curiosity,
I think that's spot
who survive.
On.
And what's one of the exceptional things about experimental film is that you have a character here who not only looks and sees and is touched, but articulates the responsibility of having to, of knowing. We have a responsibility to know things in the world, and the answer is not to close our eyes and pretend it doesn't exist. The answer is to find out a way to live with the consequences of the knowledge we have.
So you're saying there's possibly a lack of courage on the part of some of these characters, like, because a good example of that, Richard Gavin's Neither Nor. So that's the one where his cousin does the weird art.
Yeah.
But at the end of that story, he's sent something by the cousin, which he puts in a closet and never looks at.
Yeah. And it's like it.
So the story, the way that story would work is either he or a relative would open the closet and open it and look at it.
Something would happen.
Something would happen. But no, I'm not fucking looking at that thing.
I guess it's a difference in philosophy.
But there's a lack of courage on his part. You could argue.
Courage is a
And you could
a
argue the same
word.
With the guy who walks out of the cult group.
But here's the thing. If most of the time when you look at stuff.
Yeah.
You die.
No, you're right. Maybe courage is not the right word. Common sense.
There's a pragmatism and there's a survival instinct to know that if you put your hand in that dark hole where you're pretty sure there's a spider, that's probably not the wisest thing to do. I mean, as humans, we've got competing psychological urges. We have the urges towards conservatism and preservation and maintaining the status quo because that's safe and that's what worked. And that is a fine instinct and it's a necessary instinct. And we also have the other one where we want to see what's over the hill and we want to look at that thing we're told not to and we want to eat the red berries. But if we all ate the red berries, we'd probably die. So we need some people to eat the red berries and die. And some people to eat the red berries and go, oh, actually, they're sweet. They're strawberries. They're great. We should eat these. Yeah. But you also need the group of people who doesn't, who maintains what is and what is safe and who establishes the rules about keeping people safe. You need both. You need both of those impulses. And I think it's interesting that we have one book, which is a collection of short stories, which its governing thesis seems to be don't look, walk away. And this other book that says, know what you're facing and find out how to deal with it. And in both books, characters survive by following those rules.
And no one's punished. Because I don't think anyone is punished in any of those stories. Unless you call being turned into a swan at one point.
Yeah, and all being turned into a fish and a heron who are going to eat each other.
Yeah, there's maybe a little
body
bit.
Body swapping with the old arthritic woman.
Yes, there's a couple of examples.
I mean, I don't know about the idea of punishment, but certainly there are characters whose ending is not.
But like the Helen Marshall story is again another example where a character in that situation he's been asked to restore a piece of what is it? Was it Grecian or
an ancient artifact.
Yeah. He's been asked to restore it. It possibly has some mystical supernatural aspect to it. Usually these people either get possessed, go insane.
Yeah.
And someone has possibly and the original curator has gone insane.
Yes.
And again, like another example where the main character isn't the person who's probably had the story that we would normally read about happen to them. We're getting the after effects.
Yeah. And what's interesting
and therefore not punished and therefore doesn't really look because that's what happened, the looking and the punishing, so to speak.
So I do find it incredibly interesting because I think where I sit as a person is I'm the one who looks.
Yeah.
I couldn't not look. You know, I can't not look. I went to Lawrence Leung did a show at the Comedy Festival, but it was a magical show, an illusionist show, a mentalist show actually is probably the better word for it. And it was really like seriously, it was so good. At the end of it, he said, I'm going to show you how I did one of these tricks. And if you don't want to know, cover your eyes and I'll tell you when you can look again because he was putting it up on a slideshow.
Yep.
And he goes, and I'll show you. And so now you have a choice to make. Do you want to live with the idea that there is magic and mystery in the world or do you want to know how?
And did you feel better looking?
I had to look. I couldn't imagine not looking.
Okay, so you felt you would have been anxious if you'd not looked.
I couldn't. There was an answer there. It was an option to know. I am quite happy living with ambiguities, but if someone says, oh, but I have the answer, I can't not know. I cannot not know. I would look in the box. I would look in the thing. I would stay in the guy's flat and find out what the cult was with the fridge. I would do all of those things. And I think in Aickman's Heirs, I would die. And I think in experimental film, I get to continue living with my knowledge.
No, but in Aickman's, so you're saying in Aickman's Heirs, you'd actually be.
I wouldn't walk away.
No, but you would be the main, in a sense, the main character, the character who, where the shit has already happened.
The character who went crazy, the character who died, the character who doesn't walk away. And I think it's a different philosophy of what happens to you if you choose to know, if you choose to look, if you choose not to walk away. And I think a lot of horror and weird fiction and this sort of stuff punishes the looking and the knowing and rewards the walking away, often not explicitly, but in terms of what happens to the characters.
Yeah.
An experimental film is like, the more I think about it, the more I'm having trouble remembering or thinking of other books that express the not just the ability but the responsibility.
Yeah.
Of needing to know and needing to work out a way to deal with the consequences of the knowledge instead of just covering your eyes and walking away and saying it's too hard, it's too scary, I'm not.
It's funny you say that. I know we're not talking, we've spoken about the files, but it has a sting. The last section is called Sting, and in Sting there's often, you know, the monster reappears or something. But actually in her Sting, it's about Wickham herself regretting what she had done.
Mm.
And that.
Yeah.
Therefore, the responsibility, everything you've just said, really. Yeah.
Like it isn't, and I'm not saying like that. Aickman's Heirs is bad, like on a philosophical sense. It's just so interesting to compare these two very human psychological reactions to the unknown and the terrifying, and look at how they're dealt with in both texts. They're dealt with differently.
And another story that does it as well. So, I mean, we could, you know, just list every story because they nearly all do it. But Nadia Balkan's 7 Minutes in Heaven. Yeah.
Oh, about the two girl town. Who was in the cult?
No. Well, yeah, well.
Because she got brought up in the cult.
She got brought up in a cult.
Yeah, and doesn't find out till she's in college that she was a member of a cult.
Yeah, well, but it's not even clear then. I mean, it is sort of because it's a form of is Christianity, I suppose, with that. Where it prays to the beetle, not the beetle, but whatever. I mean. But
for her growing up, this was just how it was, and she doesn't find out until she's in college that, no, this is not how it is.
And possibly that she – well, so a poison gas is released in one town, is heading towards another town. Never clear whether it actually hits that town. It either hits the town, they all die, and somehow get resurrected, or the power of whatever cult it is prevents it.
But you don't know.
Again, ambiguity. But actually, this is about a story about a girl who's just living her life, who leaves the town. Because usually these stories never leave the town. You always stay there and you find more shit about it. You know, okay, you're a kid being brought up. You don't know about the cult, but then you do find out about the cult and you want to escape, but you can't escape. No, she leaves.
Yeah,
she goes to college. Okay, she comes back to visit from time to time. You know, it's about her life and this weird shit that happened around it.
It's interesting. It's like a lot of the characters in a lot of the protagonists in Aickman's Heirs are, like, as you say, they're essentially their peripheral characters in their own story.
Correct. They absolutely are.
And the ones who aren't, bad things happen.
Well, like two brothers.
Oh, that's such a good story.
Paul William. That's probably the most traditional horror story in the whole collection.
But I liked how it was handled. And I liked that you knew all along what was happening. But it was really well handled and it was creepy.
So this is about a two brothers brought up in a estate, a house.
Yeah, with their father.
With their father.
And I think, is she explicitly dead or is she certainly an absent mother?
I think she's
probably dead. And a housekeeper, tutor, nanny, everything.
Their house schooled up to a certain age and then they go off to a university/boarding school, whatever.
Like a college.
Yes. When there's a year between the two brothers. Is that Irish twins?
I don't know. I've never heard that word.
Yeah, when you have a year between.
Oh, I don't know. Siblings.
Anyway, it's probably racist. So when the older brother goes by a year, when he comes back, they're great. They get very close, these brothers. Yep. When he comes back, he's different.
Yes, he's more like his father now, grown up and standoffish. And you know, what I like about it is it makes absolutely no pretense about being anything except a metaphor about growing up and your older siblings changing before you and you're no longer friends because now suddenly the year between you is a chasm. and you know, looking at you know, the adults and not wanting to be the adult. And like it, that's what the story is, and it makes no pretense that it's anything except that. And the way it handles that subject matter and the way it uses the supernatural stuff or the suggestion of supernatural stuff, and then when he finds the other, like the body snatched boy.
Well, no, he finds essentially the cast off of his
older brother. Like the, it's like a body snatchers type thing.
Well, yeah, okay, I suppose, like a pod person. Yeah, that's right. What you mean, yeah. And, he finds the cast
off. But all of that is just – like it's a beautifully psychologically rendered story, and I really,
with that tagline sort really of at the end it. Saying, "Next year you'll be going to."
Yeah, yeah, but it's just it's because it is done. I feel as a reader, it is saying, "Hey, I'm going to write a metaphorical story about this thing," and it's done really well. Like I liked it. As you say, it's quite a conventional sort of a story, but it was just so well handled from the point of view of the younger brother who was left behind, and yeah, it was quite sad.
And what did you think? We've nearly discussed every story.
Have we?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've given some of them a bit of short shrift. Sorry, we apologise. But The Lake by Daniel Mills, which is about three boys who go off and they.
Yeah, I think that was one which, again, really good.
They jump into a lake and one of them nearly drowns.
Or does drown. Yeah. Look, I really liked it, again, up until the very end, sort of as the same with A Delicate Craft. I think it shows too much of its hand at the end. And I think I would have been more unsettled if that last.
Really? You think?
I think it does. I think the whole bit about, you know, the almost accident that he had and the woman who didn't see the other car. I all of that, yeah, it for me, it settled. It settled. And I would have been happier with a little more ambiguity at the very end.
Well, do you think the story about the guy, the old man who turns into a swan, is settled? Because what?
It is. Yes. I didn't.
Well, no, because no one else notices that he's turning into a swan.
I know. I just didn't connect with that story. And I don't know about all the later stuff going in there. It was a bit weird. I think I need to reread that story again.
The one about the guy turned.
Yeah.
Discreet music by Michael Wehunt.
Yeah, it wasn't like, and that.
Well, I think what I liked about it is that, again, it was very different in the sense that it's about a man who's still coming to terms with his sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Which I suppose is what the swan metaphor
It gets tangled up. Like, it's clearly – the end of that story is clearly a reference to the Leda and the swan Grecian myth. And it's quite tangled for me. I don't know. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about this type of a story is that sometimes it just skates off you. Like, there's a difficult line to tread between maintaining the ambiguity and the unsettledness of it and just bouncing the reader off. And it's not going to be the same reader. Like, there's stories that I've bounced off that you've really liked and vice versa.
Yeah.
So, but that's the one of the, I'm not going to say consequences. It's one of, I guess, the ways these stories work, because they're quite psychologically based, because they're playing with how your cognition works and either your need for or your repulsion from ambiguity and unsettledness, that they are the way they work, there'll be readers that just bounce off them immediately and readers who just love them, and there'll be different readers for each story. And yeah, some of these stories,
yeah, but in that story,
I could appreciate, but I didn't.
But in that story, this is a man who's hidden his true,
yeah,
he's homosexuality,
yeah,
from his wife for 42 years, who's now died, his wife.
Yeah.
And
he
loved his wife. And I thought that was a really – and I think he goes then to try and find, and then does find the man
he had an affair with.
Correct.
And the man he's had an affair with has had a family, and it's like, you can't just come back here after 40 years and expect me to have been waiting for you, which was a really poignant – like I like –
But it feels like it's a story that probably didn't eat the swan.
Yeah,
the metaphor,
thing.
The magic realist aspect
of course, when
of
you
that.
Bring in like the reference to the Leda and the swan thing, and the swan is
which is what that's about, transformation.
So the swan is Zeus, who transforms himself into a swan to rape this girl called Leda, who he quite fancies. So when you entangle and when
what's that got to do?
Because the last one of the last lines of the story is the being who appears to him and either completes the transformation or witnesses his transformation says to him, "You're now a god of want." Like, to me, that was quite clear. That was a reference to, like, you couldn't get around it. The god of want, the transforming into a swan. But when you entangle the idea of rape and all of that in and the entitlement of the god and all of the stuff that is also part of later in the Swan for me. Yeah, it's a story I couldn't quite – it was the wrong ambiguity. It was the wrong inexplicability for me. But there was stuff I liked about it, and the thing I liked about it most was I guess, the tragedy also of this character who has this life that he's led, and there's a part of his life that he hasn't been able to lead, and the expectation he has that this other man who he had this affair with is the same as him and mirrors him, and he'll just be able to go to that man and everything will be – and the other man has had this other life. Which is, like, this acknowledgement that other people have their own lives. They're not characters in your life that you can pick up when you need them. You know, it's quite...
It felt like a very personal story, yeah. But I don't know if it needed...
Yeah, that's what I mean. The Swan stuff felt... It didn't gel together. It didn't work in the way I think the author was perhaps intending.
We might as well do the set. So the only story that I think we haven't mentioned.
Okay, what's that
is,
one?
probably the one that did my head in the most. Michael Sisko's Infestations.
Oh, the apartment. The woman who goes to pack up her great aunt or someone.
It's her relative's apartment, Miriam.
That was a strange. I like that story. I cannot tell you what that story was about, but I really liked it.
The perfect expression of what you said before. You know what it's about, you just can't articulate.
I really like that story. I couldn't explain it. I couldn't even tell you what I think maybe happened. It was just a remarkable story. It kind of made you itch and just, yeah, like you were never quite sure what the story was doing and what was happening. But it was really enticing to read. I really liked it. I just can't explain
it. It's redolent with the uneasiness.
Yeah, and I can't explain.
Well, there's an ectopic pregnancy in there. Or is it ectopic? It's just that...
Well, that's what she's diagnosed with, but you don't know whether it's... Like, this is what I mean. Like, there's so much... I just really liked it. It was just a lot of, uneasy things and strange things and things that aren't explained and in a really pedestrian way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There wasn't like
yeah, it's not purple prose and
no, but also there wasn't like a big looming monster in the shadows doing like
yeah.
some of the stories, like the story about the strippers in Vegas, it's you know, the terror is quite visceral and there's whatever's happened, it's a big thing and you know, also with the boys with the lake. But this is such a small horror in a way, and it's yeah, I loved it. I really loved it. I can't tell you what it's about, but I loved it.
I
think the fact that we actually have talked about every story does show the strength of this anthology, because we don't normally do that when we talk about anthologies.
It's all a very, very highly recommended, from me anyway, group of stories, which we haven't really – you really can't spoil these stories they're because they're not that sort of – revelation.
Most of the time there is no real explanation, is there? So you just have to read the story and immerse yourself and come away with your own impression.
And the Lisa Tuttle is the perfect end.
I love the Lisa Tuttle story. I really I agree. I think it's bookend. Like this anthology is bookended really well, beginning with the Evanson as a way to set up your expectations for what kind of a anthology this is going to be. And then, yeah, the ending with the Tuttle, which maintains those expectations but is really clever and, as you say, quite metafictional. And on terms of on an editing basis, it's a very, very well put together book.
So I now feel the need that I have to read Robert Aikman.
I can lend you a book if you want.
Well, great.
I've got like four or five in my back room.
I suppose one of the things that Strance, and we'll finish up, but that Strance says in the introduction is that he didn't want authors to just ape Aikman's style.
And I think that that kind of happened, I think.
Well, I don't see how you could get around it. I don't see how, as a writer, if you're doing something called Aikman's Heirs or you're asked to do something, because the whole idea being that this is the Aikman's legacy, you know, obviously in the title, and that we want to see what these writers normally write, rather than write something that Aikman would have appreciated.
I think there's quite a difficulty. So when you say you're going to do like if you're going to do a Lovecraft heirs, and like there's been many, let's just say
every second collection.
You know, there's a lot of Lovecraft heirs-esque type anthologies out there. What authors tend to do with that is not use Lovecraft's really purple, baroque dense style so much. Though some do, and you know, squamous and eldritch often get thrown around more as a joke these days than anything else. But what they're playing with most of the time is the mythos and the creations of Lovecraft more than how he wrote the stories a lot of the time. And I think with Aickman maybe because his content, for want of a better word, is so subtle and indefinable. He doesn't have a Cthulhu. He doesn't have the horror in space. Aickman doesn't really throw anything out like that that's identifiably
No, but I think I got a good picture of Aickman reading
No, but
stories.
Just in terms of motifs oh, I get and that. Stuff yeah, yeah. like
he
that. Yeah. So
he doesn't have a franchise to fall back
I
on.
I think it's harder to disentangle the way he writes something from what he writes, and perhaps that's why a lot of the authors in this collection similarly echoed his way of writing as a way of presenting the content that they're writing about.
That's what wasn't clear to me from the introduction. Yeah. And for, as much as I love his collection, is am I meant to walk away with a, if I don't know Aickman, with an appreciation of his work by seeing what these writers have produced as influences?
Or I don't think that's
a feel
what...
of what Aickman's was about in terms of how it's expressed by these other writers?
I'd hope the latter. I'd hope that, and I think in the introduction, Strancer says that's kind of what he's wanting. He wanted writers who work in the same way and produce stories that have been inspired and influenced by Aickman, yeah. but to write these stories that produce a similar effect in the reader as Aickman's work
well,
does.
Well, okay, here's the question then. Okay, the Helen Marshall story, for example, is that a story that forget Aickman, that Helen Marshall would have written anyway, that you could see written by Helen Marshall, or do you feel that Helen Marshall has written a story that's geared to a collection about Aickman?
I have
an answer for that, but
you do. Yeah. I could imagine that story sitting in a Helen Marshall collection and not being out of place at all.
And that I'm the same. Yeah. I agree. And the Lisa Tuttle. Now I've read The Pillow Friend. It felt like that book. I can't speak for all the authors because I haven't read all.
Yeah.
The Evanson is. I've read quite a bit of his work. I could imagine that being in a Brian Evanson short story collection and not having said, oh, Aickman. Yeah, I might if I was really clever and smart and well-read. But so I think if that's the aim, and I'm pretty sure that's what he's saying in the introduction, I think he succeeds in that I can see these being stories that the authors could easily publish in a short story collection, divorced of the fact that this has been influenced by Aickman.
Yeah. The stories themselves are really
There is not a single dud.
No, there isn't. And there's in terms of editing, obviously you never know how much work an editor's done on a story, but you can always tell when a book has been badly edited, and this has not been badly edited in terms of the stories.
I have one technical question before we finish. The Nina Allen, it's a novel, it's the longest by a huge, would you put that in the centre of the collection rather than towards the end? I just don't know if it loads down.
I'm just thinking,
Jonathan Strahan here or even Simon himself. I always wonder about that when you've got stories that are about the same size. They're all around about the same size except one that's really big.
I think I've not never edited a book, but as a reader, I always think it's a smart decision to put the long, long story near the end, not at the end. I guess good.
Oh, so you were happy with its location?
I was, because I think by that point in the book, if people aren't interested in the book to the point where they're not going to make it through a novella, they'll have put the book aside anyway.
Okay.
So those of us who've gotten right almost to the end, to the three-quarter mark, and we've read all the others and we're enjoying the book enough to keep reading, we'll read that novella and we've been primed for it in a way.
Okay.
And then it was quite smart to finish off with, you could say it was a palate cleanser, the Tuttle. It was a shorter one. The style was quite different to the way Nina Allen wrote her. So it was this extra, it was this other little beat that happened. I think in terms of purely just in terms of story selection as we see it, again, we don't know what he didn't select and how he's presented it. I think it's stellar. It's a stellar anthology from just speaking from that perspective.
Okay, good. All right, so we've spoken today about Aickman's Heirs, edited by Simon Strances, and Experimental Film by Gemma Files, which we both highly recommend.
Absolutely.
And what are we going to do next week?
I don't know, Ian. You've got the sheet of paper.
Yeah. Well, first off, the answer was, we're not recording next week. Are you crazy?
No, that's very true.
And second off, you do know what we're doing next month
because
you wrote this piece of paper. But
we are going to let you read it.
We are doing Kelly Link's Get in Trouble.
Yep.
A short story collection, which was
nominated for the Pulitzer.
Well, it's a odd
shortlisted. It's mentioned in relation.
Yeah,
to.
It's more the third. I don't know how the Pulitzer comes up with winners.
Yeah,
and then mentions. And here's some other stuff we liked. Usually two books, and this was one of them.
Nice.
And then What Is Not Yours Is Not Yours by Helen Oyeyemi.
Yes.
So two short story.
Two short story collections because we love short stories and we want to read more of them. I've not read either.
Well, neither have I.
And I'm really looking forward to them.
And I haven't read Killing Link in a long time. I've never read Helen Oyeyemi, even though I should have.
No, me neither. She's been on my list for a while, and this one came up, and it might be tangentially PhD related. So I thought, well, I'll just throw that in there.
Yeah, we're basically filling gaps in our reading via Writer and the Critic. And that will also be our last podcast for the year.
It will. And advance warning, it probably won't actually go live until the first week of December because my November's crazy busy.
Anyone interested in your social calendar? I don't think so. Should I go through mine?
I think they're really interested. I have stalkers.
You say that so lightly. All right. Feedback. I love this part of the podcast.
You can never ever just read it, can you?
No. Commenting at the website, Writer and Critic. What?
You can give us feedback by commenting at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com, or you can send an email to writerandcritic@gmail.com, and you can even follow us on Twitter, which is @writerandcritic. And if you can and you're able, we'd love us if you could sponsor us on Patreon. Thank you. You don't have to read every word. You just, you know, it's a guide. You talk like you're just talking.
As a seasoned podcaster, I don't think I need to be told how to read a piece of paper.
I think so, because every time you have to read it, you do that.
It's valuating. It's humour.
Not the 10th time.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. Have a good week.
Have a good Halloween.
Have a great Halloween.
Yeah. What are you trying to say? Did you look it up?
Oh my
Did you
God,
do this?
You're so
I'm so defensive.
Okay, we're going to do that again.
No.